This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the authors of a new book that attempts to reconstruct the social history of early Christianity. It's called The Message and the Kingdom, How Jesus and Paul Ignited a Revolution and Transformed the Ancient World. Their book draws from recent studies of ancient Roman culture and from archaeological discoveries throughout the Mediterranean region. Richard Horsley is a professor of religion at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's a scholar of the New Testament, the historical Jesus, and early peasant movements. Neil Asher Silberman is the author of a previous book on the Dead Sea Scrolls and has written extensively on Near Eastern archaeological finds and their political and religious impact. Horsley and Silberman are trying to understand early Christianity in the context of the political and cultural conflicts of the time. Horsley says that religion and politics were closely connected in ancient times.
Because of the separation of religion and politics and economics in our own society, we assume that religion was separate from politics and economics in ancient society. That's simply not the case. Religion went together with social political life. It was inseparable. Jesus was not simply an individual prophet speaking to individuals in general, but we had to read this in a real context where there were real social forms of villages and families, and that the sayings of Jesus then took on quite a different sound when read in that context.
You point out in the book that recent findings from archaeological dig sites in the Middle East and the Mediterranean have changed our picture of Jesus's time. Neil Silberman, can you give us a couple of examples of recent archaeological findings that are changing our
picture?
You
know, it's the finds that people don't think about and that don't get the headlines that are the most important ones, I think. Our flaw in seeing the period of Jesus was to be seduced by the elegance and grandeur of monumental Roman architecture, while there is a whole world living in the countryside. Now, that world will never become tourist attractions in the sense of tourists coming to see these ancient sites, but scatters of potsherds that show remains of rural villages that are slowly disappearing as the Roman rule expands unlocks for us a whole process that was going on in the time of Jesus that really hasn't been understood.
What process?
The process of a globalized economy, a globalized empire. We have to look at the Roman Empire as a period of tremendous upheaval and revolution in the Mediterranean world, where formerly very localized economies, even regionalized economies, were slowly brought within the grasp of a world economy and made to serve the markets and the economic needs of that. In many ways, it's reminiscent of the modernization of the third world or the modernization of the world today, where people that had for generations lived in villages aiming at subsistence were now forced to deal with money, with markets, with employment, and with what the market demanded they produce.
With the market being Rome?
The market being the Rome and its provincial capitals, ultimately Rome, of course.
So where does Jesus himself fit into this system?
Just at the time that Jesus was born, roughly in 4 BCE, Herod the Great had died, and the Romans separated his kingdom and assigned Galilee and Perea to one of his sons, Antipas. So when Antipas then established a capital in Galilee, in the city of Sepphoris first, and then he built a second capital in Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee, for the first time in Galilean history, the rulers were living right there in Galilee and within a day's walk of any of those villages. And that meant that with Antipas trying to sort of make his mark as a Roman client king, he needed resources. The source of those resources was the peasant produce. And so it looks as though there was an intensification of taxation and collection of taxes. And Antipas, of course, wanted to generate what other resources he could generate. So there he developed a salt fish industry. And Just in building a capital of Tiberias, he displaced peasant villages and forced villagers to come into that city to provide the kind of labor and artisans and so forth that he needed. So the impact right in the generation of Jesus, the generation in which Jesus grew up, must have been tremendous on those villages. And then the villagers would have been disrupted, falling into debt because of the heavy taxation, hungry. And those are exactly the kinds of issues that we can see Jesus addressing in the Gospels.
Terry, let me give you a specific example of the kind of changes that we postulate, we try to sketch out here in the world of Jesus. Jesus' ministry, of course, we're in the small villages around the Sea of Galilee, and we tend to have this very idealized, romantic view of the apostles casting their nets upon the water and the peaceful Sea of Galilee. But what the archaeology shows us is that intensification that Dick was talking about. In fact, Magdala, or Tarichaeae, the city where Mary Magdalene is from, was known by that Latin name, salt fish. The Romans were very fond, for instance, of very thick, very spicy fermented fish sauces, and that required tons and tons of fish to be fermented and rendered down into these jars that were exported throughout the Mediterranean. And what actually happened at the time of Jesus was not this peaceful fishing, but fishing on the Sea of Galilee turned from a fairly seasonal occupation of farmers into a massive industrialized process in which quotas had to be met, and the fishing went on day and night, year round. And what you have for the fishermen that Jesus said that he would make them fishers of men was a response to what we can now see from archaeology, the sudden pickup and intensification, and the peaceful life of Galilee was suddenly disrupted in a way that no one had expected to happen.
So you're saying that even the fishermen disciples were going through an enormous period of social and economic upheaval.
Particularly the fishermen, in that there was an unprecedented intensification in their work. And so the whole symbol of the fish is something that was caught. The fishermen that were pressed to catch more and more give a new interpretation when we hear Jesus say, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men," with the same intensity that the fishermen were having to catch fish, for instance.
Tell us a little bit about things that you've learned about what religion was like during the time of Jesus in the Roman Empire.
One of the most interesting things that I've come to see is something I mentioned before, that you just simply can't separate religion from other dimensions of life. That for the ordinary people living in villages, religion was a matter of growing their crops and having enough to eat, a matter of having a parcel of land in your family that you would pass down from generation to generation. And then, of course, at the higher level, at the level of the temple in Jerusalem, the temple wasn't simply a religious institution; it was a political and economic institution as well. In fact, we should speak really of this society as a temple state, where the temple was the central political, economic, and religious institution. And then, of course, and this is something we don't often think about, once the Romans came in, Caesar wasn't simply the political ruler and wasn't simply taking tribute. Caesar claimed to be a god and the savior of the world. And there's a religious dimension to the Roman imperial rule. So it's a whole different picture from the kind of sort of individual piety and ethics that I grew up with that emerges from studying the Gospels in the context of the ancient society.
Richard Horsley, you're a scholar of peasant movements, and you see Jesus as being the leader of a peasant movement. But of course, Jesus was also talking about God. I mean, he was talking about, obviously, religious things. So how do you reconcile him as the leader of a peasant movement, but also, you know, being different because of this, you know, larger spiritual thing that he was talking about, too?
The spiritual dimension is not separate from the other dimensions of life, including raising crops, for example. Yes, Jesus talks about God, and he's coming from the whole Israelite biblical tradition, which represents God as concerned about people. concerned about the quality and the shape of people's lives. In the traditional Mosaic covenant, we think of often as the Ten Commandments. Think of those commandments of given by God on Sinai: "Thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not swear falsely." Those are religious obligations, indeed, but they're also principles of what do we call them? Social policy. They're principles by which people in a village community relate to each other, and it maintains a wholesome and just social life in the village and in the larger society.
My guests are Richard Horsley and Neil Asher Silberman, authors of the new book, The Message and the Kingdom. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the historical Jesus and the social and political upheaval in the time of Jesus. My guests are the two authors of the book, The Message and the Kingdom. Richard Horsley is a professor of religion at the University of Massachusetts at Boston and a scholar of the historical Jesus. Neil Silberman has written about the political and religious controversies surrounding archaeology of the ancient world, and he's the author of a book on the Dead Sea Scrolls. In ancient Roman times, what was the role of the emperor within the larger pagan system?
There's a brilliant book by a man named S.R.F. Price, which was really changing the way we're looking at the Caesar religion, at the imperial cult.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his theses is that what the Greek cities did with the advent of the empire, they were confronting a power that they hadn't confronted before in the Roman emperor, having sort of taken over rule of the whole world. And what they did was to integrate that power into their city religions, the traditional Greek religion. So not only would they make new temples to Caesar, but they would put statues of Caesar in the temples to the various gods that they already worshipped, like Asclepius or Athena. That all over the Eastern Mediterranean, the imperial cult was integrated with traditional Greek religion. And then second thing they did was to reconstruct the, here's where archaeology opens this up to us, they reconstructed the city centers so that it was centered on the imperial temples and the imperial shrines. And so the way Price puts it, that the imperial presence simply pervaded public space. The presence of the emperor was all around in the center of the cities like Corinth and Athens and Ephesus, the principal areas of Paul's mission.
And for people like Jesus and later Paul, that kind of public ideology was the worst kind of idolatry.
Why?
Well, because what it spoke about was centralizing everything and giving homage to this emperor that had no place in the tradition of Israel, that had no place in that ancient code of behavior by which God had a direct relationship with every individual and every community. The idea of rendering unto Caesar was something that was absolutely intolerable, both on its face and on the effects that it had of increased taxation, of changing and disintegrating, in a way, the traditional village life of the time.
In your book, you say that the story of Jesus' resurrection set the apostles' message apart from other reformist creeds of the ancient world. How does the resurrection set it apart? I want you to explain what you mean there.
To understand resurrection, we need to get right back into the context of Jewish society under the Roman Empire. The Jews had been under empires for centuries by this time, and the Roman Empire was particularly onerous for them. And part of the response to being under these empires was the development of something that's often called in the literature apocalypticism. And apocalypticism had as its basic message that God had not abandoned the people. God was still with the people. And God would take action to, first of all, restore the people, and secondly, to judge the empire that was dominating them, to get the empire off their backs, and thirdly, to bring back to life the faithful people who had been martyred for the cause, who had been martyred because they had stuck to their guns in the traditional way of life and had resisted the Roman and imperial encroachments. Now, it's in the context of that belief in Jewish apocalypticism that we need to see Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Here are these earliest followers of Jesus trying to figure out what's happened. And they're following a leader of a movement of the restoration of Israel, so they can see that here God is acting to restore the Israelite society, and they're just hoping that the Romans would disappear or God would take action against the Romans finally, and now their leader has become a martyr to the cause, and. They already know of this idea of resurrection, that God would restore the martyrs in this general resurrection. And so with that frame of mind, they came quickly to believe and then told these stories that God had raised Jesus. And that wasn't just an individual resurrection. That was the beginning of the resurrection. And then that was so exciting for that movement that it sort of mixed those three agenda items up. Since God has already raised Jesus, that means that God is acting not only to restore Israel, but is all the more certain to soon be taken action against the Roman Empire that is dominating us.
Neil Silberman, I'm wondering if recent archaeological finds offer any insights into the story of Jesus' resurrection.
Really, this is a subject that, as I said, is really impossible with the tools of archaeology. What we do know a lot about is the process of crucifixion and its role in Roman society and how horrible a public spectacle it was.
You point out that most crucified bodies were not buried.
Well, that's what really makes the resurrection so important, although this isn't a strictly archaeological find. There has been, in Jerusalem in recent years, we've had the advantage of tremendous development, not only in Jerusalem, but throughout the Mediterranean, to give us more archaeological excavations and a better picture. But in Jerusalem, hundreds and hundreds of tombs from the time of Jesus have been excavated, and yet only a single tomb has been found with a body with any traces of crucifixion. This is especially rare because from the historical accounts, we know that hundreds, if not thousands, of people were crucified in Jerusalem during the period of Roman rule. So what this has brought up is examining what crucifixion meant, the fact that the bodies of those crucified people were left hanging on the crosses as more of a public example than capital punishment, and left to be eaten by scavengers and if they were lucky, to be bought back by their family for a proper burial. But that apparently, from the archaeological finds, didn't happen much.
The holidays of Hanukkah and Christmas are coming, and I'm wondering if you could reflect on what it's like for you to watch all the kind of religious and commercial, celebration and to do around those holidays, you know, from your perspectives as a scholar of religion and a scholar of archaeology.
Terry, one of the books I did earlier, 6, 7, 8 years ago now, was called The Liberation of Christmas. And the motive there was just what you're talking about. It's seeing the what seems like an extreme discrepancy between the original Christmas story and then the commercialization of the holy days in our society. It's been quite a revelation to realize that what we know of as American Christmas has many roots other than the original story of Jesus's birth. In fact, it's interesting to realize that Hanukkah in the United States Jewish community is much more of a celebration than Hanukkah is in other countries for Jews, and that probably has something to do with what's come to be the American consumer Christmas.
What's so ironic is that in the trappings, so many of the trappings of modern Christmas are lots of the symbols of the emperor cult in terms of the bows and the trumpets and the heavenly music. I mean, if we didn't know that Jesus had occurred, we would think that this is a sort of vestigial remembrance of the Roman emperor cult in midwinter.
So you're saying it's almost like a form of idolatry.
Yes.
Well, originally, the birth of Jesus, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Dick, Originally, the birth of Jesus was celebrated in the springtime. It was only several centuries later that it was changed to December 25th, which was always the time for the celebration of the Roman imperial gods, of the beginning of the new civil year. And when we look at archaeological trappings of the emperor cult in Zanker's book that Dick mentioned, of pine boughs, of trumpets, of all kinds of heavenly figures attending the birth of the immortal Caesar, we begin to see that symbolically this is quite similar, not to the resistance to empire, right, but over the centuries of the organized Christianity, the trappings of the emperor creeped in, and what we have is not resistance against the idea of a king, but it's sort of apotheosis.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, it's our pleasure.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Richard Horsley and Neil Asher Silberman are the authors of the new book, The Message and the Kingdom, How Jesus and Paul Ignited a Revolution and Transformed the Ancient World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.